A trusted voice of truth and light.
God gave me a gift. I shovel well. I shovel very well.
And a rally point for those who've accepted the reality that they are not sheep.
We've got a blind date with destiny.
And it looks like she's ordered the lobster.
This is the Brian Hyde Show.
Well, hello there and welcome to the show. Just in case you're wondering, this is a program that recognizes that the illiterate of the 21st century aren't the people who can't read and write. It's the people who can't recognize poorly crafted propaganda being fed to them in ever-shortening news cycles. By the way, hat tip to Peter Quinones for that brilliant observation, but that's really what this is about. This is a program about thinking clearly, thinking independently, questioning the narrative, although I've got to warn you, people get angry. When you question the narrative, they don't like it for some reason, and yet it's the right thing to do. And I'll explain why as we continue deeper into the show. Look, I don't have all the answers. I don't know everything. I know that I don't know a whole lot, which is probably the best place to start, but I appreciate you making this journey with me. Come revel in wrongthink, and we'll find some friends along the way and hopefully some great information sources as well. I have some great sponsors who make this show possible on a daily basis. If you look on my show notes page at thebrianhydeshow.com, just click on today's show notes or any day's show notes for that matter. You'll see names like Dixie Chiropractic and HSL Ammo, Sewing and Quilting Center, Monticello College, Life Saving Food, the Heather Turner team at Patriot Home Mortgage, and Govern Your Crypto. All great sponsors, all making this program possible on a day-to-day basis. So it was a pretty busy weekend, and of course, speaking of, poorly disguised propaganda dominating the ever-shortening news cycle, there was a shooting in Buffalo, New York. And, if you just want to compare the numbers, it was a pretty small body count compared to the number of people shot over the weekend in Chicago. Now, I'm not trying to minimize the tragedy of it. I'm just saying the news media's attention, though, is 100% focused on this because this was a pretty heinous act. And at first glance, it looks like some young kid, 18-year-old kid, lost his marbles, like 180 pages of manifesto lost his marbles and went on a shooting spree. And it was it's being used right now to foment, a gun violence crisis or gun violence epidemic, right? Because everything's a matter of public health. And the Democrats know that they are going up against the wall, so to speak, for the midterms coming up in November. I mean, I know it sounds conspiratorial. I would roll my eyes too if someone says, well, maybe it's time for a false flag. But you know what? If whether this is or isn't a false flag, it's certainly grist for the mill. And right now you have politicians just eagerly blaming their political foes to try to gain some sort of political advantage. And it's pretty sad stuff. Now, I watched a short clip of the guy first getting out of his car and just it stops right after he shoots the first person he sees, which I mean it's chilling. And the takeaway I have here is not that guns are bad and AR-15s with racist sayings written on them are even worse. It's that you just don't know how quickly something like this can happen, how quickly your day can go to hell without any warning. And I'm not talking about, but therefore everybody, needs to carry a gun and you can be the hero with your little Sig Sauer pistol. You can stop this guy. It's pretty terrifying when someone puts a great deal of planning and thought into how can I take as many lives as possible and then follows through on it. And yet, as horrific as this guy's assault was, and I think 10 people died as a result of his shooting spree, it's nothing. It's not even a drop in the ocean compared to the number of bodies stacked up by governments which are allowed to operate beyond limits of their power and operate with basically unlimited authority. So when you hear people stumping for, well, we got to have more gun control, we got to protect everybody, please understand, it's not about protecting you, it's about protecting whoever is in power. And it's just a convenient excuse to get you and me hyped up and scared and look, oh, they're waving the bloody shirt. Wow. Wow, this must be really serious. I guess we should give up more freedom so that we can all feel safe. Now, the ones who want to feel safe are the politicians who are busy painting you and me into a corner. And the reason they want to ban so-called assault weapons is because they realize no matter how many nuclear bombs they have, no matter how many missiles, tanks, submarines, and jet fighters, they cannot subjugate a population without people who are willing to go to each house and physically try to control the people. They can't do that when the people have a means of saying no. Sorry, I feel like I'm starting off on a bit of a radical note today. All right, well, let's dial it back a little bit. Considering how our economy's wheezing along on life support, it's kind of hard to imagine why American politicians are so eager to give away taxpayers' money. I'm specifically talking about the not $40 billion, but $56 billion package going to Ukraine. Jordan Schachtel in his dossier Substack asks, you know, where is this money actually going? In fact, he says this may be the making of a money laundering operation. Jordan Schachtel says the United States has now delegated some $56 billion in new money to debase the currency for Ukraine, but hardly any of it is actually going to the Ukrainian people. Due to President Trump, the D.C. war machine spent 2016 to 2020 starving for a monetary replenishment. In other words, he didn't go out and start any new wars. But now that they have their man in the White House, along with easy consensus in the legislature, it's time to cash in. So wherever your opinion resides on this proxy war, inter-Slavic spat 5,000 miles away on the Russian-Ukraine border region, reality cannot be denied. The $56 billion and counting in aid for Ukraine that's passing through the American legislature primarily serves the purpose of greasing the skids of the D.C. Beltway ruling class. Oh, and you're paying for it. Now, if you think the people of Ukraine are going to see one dime of this money, think again. Not even the humanitarian aid portions of the assistance will reach the Ukrainian people. Instead, it will be absorbed by a variety of D.C. lawyers, lobbyists, non-governmental organizations, and other well-connected middlemen. You know, if you want to reference this, you can see Afghanistan. Now, U.S. Senator Rand Paul has actually stymied efforts to pass this Ukraine aid bill because he wants to know, where is the money actually going? And, oh, man, people, he's working for Putin. John McCain was right. Oh, boy, if you got to appeal to John McCain as your source of authority, moral authority, you've got problems, my friend. Jordan Schachtel says if they gave the bill a more accurate title, it would be called the Money for Raytheon and Friends Bill, as the majority of the funds from the latest $40 billion behemoth will be used to supply weapons purchase orders and resupply weapons that were already sent to Ukraine, which arrived with a seeming backroom deal to add to the deep pockets of the weapons manufacturers back home. And he says those who have become consumed by corporate press and government war propaganda are being used as useful marks for this agenda. Since the beginning of this conflict, Schachtel says the corporate press and government propagandists, yes, one and the same, have been labeling the war with a nonsensical good versus evil narrative, which has helped to demand consensus in D.C. Notably, not a single Democrat voted against the bill. Republicans largely support it, and the Uniparty is outraged that Rand Paul decided to hold up its emergency passage. Well, he says, if you had any doubt about who's running the show in Ukraine, here's Zelensky's top advisor and Ukrainian foreign minister promoting a CNN clip and condemning Rand Paul via faux moral outrage. I don't even know how to say this person's name because this is written in Cyrillic, but we all saw a CNN video where Russian soldiers shot civilians in the back just for fun. How many such crimes are happening at the moment in the east and south of Ukraine? Price of delay per day, hundreds killed and raped, price per week, thousands. Have a nice morning coffee, Rand Paul. Wow. Now, this is only the beginning of the money printing for Ukraine, in quotation marks. Jordan Schachtel says, Uniparty legislators agree they will need to print more money, much more money for Ukraine in the coming months, if not sooner. Sadly for the people of Ukraine, they won't see one penny of the $56 billion plus and counting delegated for Ukraine, and it's all by design. This latest replenishment bill more resembles money laundering via the narrative of America's undeclared war against Russia, although Steny Hoyer kind of spilled the beans last week, didn't he? Money's being printed and distributed to a small group of wealthy regime insiders on the backs of the American taxpayers. Now, I understand that's pushing back against a lot of the official narrative, right? I stand with Ukraine, and, you know, look at the stickers I've got in the avatars. Look, blue and yellow. I stand with Ukraine. Look, you can stand with the Ukrainian people. You can be sympathetic for what is happening there and the suffering that's going on. But there's a bigger picture here that needs to be addressed. And as much as you may want to believe, well, our government is the good guys. Look at us. We're the beacon of freedom and democracy. You're not going to find good guys if you look close enough. You're going to realize our leaders, Ukraine's leaders, yes, Russia's leaders, all corrupt, all looking out for their own interests, and insisting that you and I fund whatever is taking place. Somehow that just doesn't strike me as fair.
This is the Brian Hyde Show. This is the Brian Hyde Show.
Hey, welcome back to the show. I want to give a shout out here to sewingandquiltingcenter.com. They are actually located in St. George, Utah, which is great news for anybody within Southern Utah. But you may actually, you know, depending on wherever you live, you may still want to avail yourselves of their services, which are the finest sewing machines, embroidery machines, long arm quilting machines from entry level, you know, under $200 up to, well, you know, the sky's almost the limit when it comes to some of these long arm quilters. I mean, they're not cheap, but they really do a marvelous job, and it would be worth your time, especially if you or someone you love enjoys sewing or the arts around sewing, to check them out. Because not only will they sell you your machines, they'll sell you the supplies that you need to use. They'll service whatever it is that you sew with or embroider with or do long arm quilting with. And this is the best part to me. They'll actually train you on how to use them. I mean, we're talking free classes to so you can get the best use out of your machine. Now, that's a great way to make sure that your investment is a wise one. Click on the link I provide in my show notes at thebrianhydeshow.com. That's sewingandquiltingcenter.com. Well, we've all witnessed the manner in which our lives can be commandeered in the name of public health. And this week, let's see, is it, what is today? Today's the 16th. Okay, so maybe, yeah, it's this week. We are very likely to see World Health Organization moving into a position of global importance in terms of controlling public health and therefore your life. Got a great article here from Deborah Hine. This is from AmericanGreatness.com. And it talks about amendments to the World Health Organization's international health regulations, which would create an unaccountable global bureaucracy with the power to impose Shanghai-style lockdowns in U.S. cities, with or without our consent. Oh, yeah, I know. If you're a fan of lockdowns, you know, that's gotta thrill you. If you're not so much a fan of lockdowns, yeah, like me, the hair on the back of your neck is probably standing up going, wait a minute, they want to do what? So Deborah Hines says, without much attention from the corporate media, the World Health Organization will soon vote on a hair-raising proposal to give itself control over health surveillance, reporting, and management worldwide. In January, Lois Pace, the Biden administration's delegate to the World Health Organization, submitted amendments to 13 articles of the international health regulations. Now, the Biden regime's proposal is scheduled for a vote during the 75th World Health Assembly held at the Palais des Nations in Geneva, May 22nd through the 28th. These regulations, adopted by 194 member states in 2005, allow the World Health Organization to declare a public health emergency of international concern if it believes that an infectious disease outbreak has occurred in a member state, but only with the consent of said member state. Now, Biden regime's new amendments would give the World Health Organization Director General control over the declaration of a public health emergency in a member state, even over the objection of that member state. Interesting shift. The proposed amendments also empower World Health Organization regional directors to declare a public health emergency in member states. Now, disconcertingly, the World Health Organization under Article 9 would be able to rely on sources for information leading to a declaration of public health emergency while maintaining the confidentiality of the source. That doesn't speak well for accountability, now does it? As the World Council for Health points out, those sources could include Big Pharma, the World Health Organization funders like the Gates Foundation and the Gates-founded and funded Gavi Alliance, as well as others seeking to monopolize power, and to say nothing of China. So the World Council for Health, a coalition of health-focused organizations and civil society groups, explains how the proposal weakens sovereignty in the member states. Quote, under Article 12, when the World Health Organization receives undisclosed information concerning a purported public health threat in a member state, the Director General may, not must, consult with the World Health Organization Emergency Committee and the member state. However, he or she can unilaterally declare a potential or actual public health emergency of international concern. The Director General's authority replaces national sovereign authority. This can later be used to enforce sanctions on nations. End quote. Did you hear that? If the World Health Assembly adopts the amendments, Article 59 says member states have 6 months to reject them. Silence equals consent. So if a member state fails to object by November, the World Health Organization will consider the amendments adopted in full, and the Director General will disregard any objection or reservation following that November deadline. Now, Deborah Hines says the implications are frightening, and they're not difficult to see. According to the WCH, the proposed regulatory changes are nothing less than an attempt to establish a globalist architecture of worldwide health surveillance, reporting, and management. Consistent with a top-down view of governance, the public will not have opportunities to provide input or criticism concerning the amendments, the group said. This, of course, is a direct violation of the basic tenets of democracy and can be compared to the separate new pandemic treaty. End quote. So the WCH is calling on the people of the world and all sovereign nations to band together and stop the World Health Organization's power grab. In a statement on its website, the group declared it opposes the unnecessary and dystopian move towards centralized control of public health. Actually, they put it this way, quote, this harmful model assumes that only the centralized and unaccountable World Health Organization bureaucracy understands how to manage the health policy of every state and, by implication, the health of each and every individual. It also assumes wrongly that Big Pharma's controversial model of medicine, which is the World Health Organization's preferred model, is the expert guide to better health and wellness. End quote. So, put simply, in the event of a pandemic, the World Health Organization's constitution would replace every country's constitution. That's what WCH's Dr. Tess Lori warns on her Substack. Whether your country's elected government would agree or not, the World Health Organization could impose lockdowns, testing regimes, enforce medical interventions, dictate all public health practice, and much more. Doesn't that sound like a great idea? Now, Lori wrote about her participation in a call with the World Health Organization as part of its public participation process last month. She says they gave 2 days to make video submissions, and written submissions had to be received by a certain time. That's 5 days for the world's citizens to have their voices heard. And she says there were 48 people on the call at the time that she joined in. 16 of them were World Health Organization staff. Others were from UNAIDS, the Coalition for Epidemic Preparedness Innovations, the UN Environment Program, the Association of Southeast Asian Nations. And she shared what she heard from the globalists who were in on the call, which included calls for human security-centric, not health security-centric policies. Apparently, they want to control not just your body, but every aspect of your life. Fast approval of emergency diagnostics and unified regulatory registration for diagnostics. In other words, more control. Equitable access to vaccines and a mechanism to hold violators accountable. So if a nation concludes a vaccine is unsafe, the World Health Organization would have the power to override that and jab their population anyway. Also, an absurd 100-day vaccine development timeline. Now, most drugs take a decade to be tested adequately and declared safe. COVID vaccines have harmed more than 3.5 million people cataloged in the World Health Organization's own database. That might actually be a conservative number. So this is pretty scary. The World Health Organization having authority to intervene and override U.S. government policy without our permission or input. Now, I do happen to subscribe to the idea that, unless there's a treaty, or unless there is a constitutional amendment, no treaty is going to supersede the Constitution. I don't know, maybe that's a matter we could send to the Supreme Court. It's not like they're busy with anything, right? Nonetheless, this has all the earmarks of a power grab writ large. Now, of course, it's all being justified. It's for your health. We're only trying to protect you. And all we need in order to protect you is absolute complete control, not just of your health, but every other aspect of your life. Gee, what could possibly go wrong?
This is the Brian Hyde Show. This is the Brian Hyde Show.
Hey, welcome back to the show. Want to mention lifesavingfood.com, one of my great sponsors, also a sponsor that is providing a very necessary service to my listeners, namely food storage and emergency preparedness. You know, just in case something gets kind of squirrely in our world. I know everything is going very well right now and everything is progressing smoothly under the firm and steady hand of our leader, Joe Biden. I'm sorry, I can't even say it with a straight face. I look at the Capitol building, or you know, where the Senate and where Congress meets, and I think, man, that is essentially the world's largest nursing home right there. And the White House, it's more of a long-term care facility these days. Nevertheless, if you want to be prepared, this doesn't mean you're going to necessarily avoid all the problems, but you're going to at least have options. Be able to say no when someone offers you, you know, aid that you just have to give up a few freedoms and we'll help you. Wouldn't it be nice to say no? See, if you have food storage, if you have items for self-reliance, water filters, solar cooking, and so forth, you have options that those who don't have these things won't have. So, lifesavingfood.com. There's a link in my show notes at thebrianhydeshow.com. Okay, here's a tough question for you. What are we to do when our government rejects everything we believe in? Well, I dug up an old article from Fred Reed. And if you're not familiar with Fred Reed, I'm going to just warn you, the guy is a curmudgeon and he is proud as a curmudgeon. But one of the things I have come to love about Fred is he just flat out says what he's thinking, politically incorrect or not. But as you'll hear, this is a guy who thinks things through. He's not just shooting from the hip. He actually has given some serious thought. And his answer is, you know, when the government is fighting against and rejecting everything that you believe in, the word you're looking for is disengagement. This is an article written back in 2011. Remember how mellow things were back in 2011? Wow. Well, he says, when a country works reasonably well, when the schools teach algebra and not governmentally mandated appropriate values, when the police are scarce and courteous, when government is remote and minds its business and works more for the benefit of the country than for looters and special interests, then pledging to it a degree of allegiance isn't foolish. Decades back, America was such a country, imperfect as all countries are, but good enough to cherish. Well, he says, as decline begins and government becomes oppressive, self-righteous, and ruthless yet incompetent, as official spying flourishes, as corruption sets in hard and institutions rot, it's time to disengage. Loyalty to a country is a choice, he says, not an obligation. In other times, people have loved family, friends, common decency, tribe, regiment, or church instead of country. In an age of national collapse, he says, this is wise. A fruitful field of disengagement might be called domestic expatriation, the recognition that living in a country makes you a resident, not a subscriber. It's one thing to be loyal to a government that's loyal to you. Another thing entirely to continue that loyalty when the brown shirts march and the government rejects everything that you believe in. While the phrase has become unbearably pretentious, it is possible to regard oneself as a citizen of the world rather than of the Reich. Homeschooling is an admirable form of disengagement for those who cannot physically expatriate. He says the primary schools once taught enough of reading and arithmetic and little enough of mediocritizing propaganda, as to render them other than pernicious. Today, no. Here it is worth reflecting, contrary to governmental insistence that schools are needless, at least for bright children. An intelligent child quickly reads several years ahead of his grade level, at which point school becomes only an obstacle. He will be savagely bored regarding his teachers as imbeciles and learn nothing that justifies his being there, but much that justifies being somewhere else. In the deepening twilight, homeschooling becomes almost a responsibility, a parallel to medieval monks copying Greek manuscripts. He says disengagement from the system of universities, or as I should say, universities, is also advisable. Now, this is true because, first, if you seek cultivation to gain a grasp of such matters as history, literature, the arts and sciences, you can do it better on your own. Professors serve little purpose other than to ensure that the student does his homework. If the student wants to study, he can do it by himself. If he doesn't want to study, well, he has no business in a university. Second, universities these days, with exceptions, I hope, are citadels of intellectual darkness. He says they teach little, they chiefly serve to force the young to borrow back-breaking sums from colluding banks. The wasted time and phenomenal cost cannot be justified unless they provide some remarkable recompense, and they do not. Universities largely prepare the student for a life of office work in some dismal institution, trapping him in the retirement system and making him a prisoner of the state. In a nation subsiding into the third world, institutions cannot be counted on. Now, I just got to hit the pause button here for a minute. He wrote this 11 years ago. Just so we're clear. It's kind of withstood the test of time, though, right? Fred Reed goes on to say it makes more sense to become, say, a commercial diver or a master auto mechanic. The training costs less than the piratical fifth-rate USOs, university-shaped objects. Both are interesting, challenging, and well-remunerated, which cannot be said of law for most who do not go into Wall Street. Crucially important, cars can be found everywhere, and such as oil companies the world over need divers. You're not tied to the United States, where the death rattle begins to be heard over the thump of the storm boot trooper's boots. He says disengagement from the consumerist zeitgeist is essential. Yes, I know. Distaste for a life dedicated to buying the unnecessary can seem a pose. I am of such lofty character that I do not dirty my philosophical hands with mere things. But he says, no, it's not a pose. In a time of economic retrogression, rejection of consumerism is utterly practical and almost treasonous. So one might ask oneself, what do I really need and what things really matter to me? How much money do I really need and how much am I willing to pay to get it? Remember, you pay more for money than anything else. Now, Fred says, I once lived briefly in an old one-bedroom trailer set in a patch of pine woods near Farmville, Virginia. A brick barbecue came with it and a large floppy pooch, apparently a mixture of Irish setter and whatever was around. But he says the place was blessedly quiet. Birds and bugs aren't noise. When it rained, he says, I delighted in being almost in the storm, but dry. I think the whole shebang cost the owner $5,000, including a well and septic system. Now, he says, if you were thinking, why, no, I couldn't possibly live that way. You're probably right. But he says, if I were doing it now, I would have staggering amounts of pirated music on today's monstrous memory sticks, a set of very decent speakers for a few hundred doomed green ones, a Kindle or the free computer version for reading books from Amazon, if I had the money, or Project Gutenberg if I didn't, and a fairly large flat screen for watching movies donated by uTorrent. Net cost, under a grand. Now, Fred Reed says, circumstances differ, yes, but you get the idea. Comfort, quiet, music, books, barbecue, undefined dog, storms, friends, for practically nothing. Mutatis mutandis, the principle applies almost everywhere. It also fits well with Fred's bifurcate law of economic independence. If you can't pay for it, don't buy it. And if you don't need it, don't buy it. Therein lie the seeds of the utter destruction of America, but he says, I'm not Wall Street's mother. So he says, to labor the point a tad, where he lives near Guadalajara in Mexico, at least two friends are living quite comfortably on about $1,000 a month. to include beer, internet, and in one case, substances crucial to the bloated salaries of the DEA. Each has a tired truck, but no granite countertops or riding mower. Another step toward independence is to disengage to the extent possible from the maintenance cycle. You are much better off in bad times if you can do the kind of plumbing, wiring, and auto maintenance that used to be commonly understood. Now, he says, this is easy to say, I know. Yet, if done, it gets you farther off the grid. Now, again, circumstances differ, details vary, but the principle remains. Disengage, cut your expenses, seek the interstices, and don't believe in anything unless you are sure it was your idea to believe in it. What is coming looks to be ugly. If so, it will be every man for himself, his family, his friends, and what principles he believes. The government, he says, doesn't give a one itolated damn about you. Sorry, I'm going to have to go find my thesaurus so I can just figure some of that out, but I think he's absolutely right. And again, I'm looking at this from the standpoint of Fred Reed wrote this 11 years ago, but it seems more true today than ever. Comfort, quiet, music, books, barbecue, undefined dog, storms, friends. Sounds like a pretty rich life to me. I have some thoughts on this and the others in the next segment. I'm going to share a few thoughts on could we get by on less than we deserve? Could we become comfortable with less than we deserve? Maybe even comfortable with discomfort? For the answers to these and other exciting questions, stay with us. We'll be back in just a few moments.
This is the Brian Hyde Show. This is the Brian Hyde Show.
Hey, welcome back to the show. Just a shout out here for HSLAmmo.com. This is new, high quality, new and remanufactured ammunition. And it's put together by the great crew at HSL Ammo under the dedicated guidance and leadership of my friend Spencer Worthington. I have a link included on my show notes page. You can just click on that if you want to see what they have in stock, if you want to order from them. If you're lucky enough to live in southern Utah, you can actually pick your stuff up locally. Great place to do business, great way to turn your money into skill, or to just sock away some precious metals, or semi-precious metals, as the case may be, for a rainy day. I know some people who are like, you know, I don't put so much faith in the dollar anymore, but ammunition as a commodity is one of those things that will always have utility. It's a little something to think about. So I'm going to share an article with you here from Annie Holmquist from intellectualtakeout.org in just a few moments. But before I go there, I want to share a couple of thoughts on a video that I watched over the weekend. Now, this was primarily a religious video. It was essentially a woman who was commenting on emotional preparedness for the second coming of Jesus. And I realize that's not going to be relevant for a lot of people. Some people are going to be, well, I don't even believe, so why would this matter? But there was something that she pointed to that I thought was immensely important, because regardless of whether you are a person of faith or not, at some point you will find freedom in learning to become comfortable with pain and with grief. And when she says grief, she's not just talking about, you know, a loved one dying, but actual loss. And I want you to think back on some of the things that would cause you grief from loss. I mean, look, when I had to sell my Mustang last year when we were moving. And yeah, there was a bit of grief that went along with that. Sometimes when you lose a job, there's grief associated with that. When a friendship ends, there is grief that's associated with it. And her point is simply this. It's not something that can be avoided, nor should we try to avoid it. As with most difficulties or challenges, the way to go is forward. You keep moving through it. You embrace it for what it is, and you move through it. But it was the idea of becoming comfortable, or at least accepting that, yep, this is part of life. This is part of the natural laws that govern this planet and this existence, and you just have to learn to deal with it, make the best of it, and move on rather than, you know, be permanently stunted in a state of victimhood and self-pity forever and ever. I understand those losses, and the pain can come in different ways and different shapes and sizes for everybody. But to me, there just seemed to be so much wisdom in her approach. And I have to say, I do believe that her approach, which included, you know, you can always take that pain, you can always take that grief and appeal to God. Specifically, you can appeal to Jesus to help you carry that burden or to take that burden off of your shoulders. I think that's actually very wise as well. But for those who don't believe, I still think there's wisdom in at least becoming comfortable with the idea that, you know what, I'm going to experience loss, but I'm not going to let that stop me in my tracks. I will continue to move forward, and I will continue to find happiness where I can. And by embracing and becoming comfortable with moving forward through it, you know, it's anybody who has... Anybody who's served in the military, you know, as you're going through your basic training, probably at some point you were told, embrace the suck. You know, yes, it sucks. We're working you hard. If you work with a personal trainer, probably get the same kind of thing. Yes, it's hard. I know you feel like you want to throw up. Keep going. Push through it. And I share this with you just because I believe all of us are going to have to get used to some pretty big adjustments. I don't know when. But the trajectory that we're on right now likely means that all of us are going to be dealing with the grief of losing retirement accounts, you know, the life savings, maybe losing homes, losing, you know, family members, losing, you know, businesses. We've already seen that happen over the last couple of years. This is about developing the resilience to be the kind of people who can endure and actually grow from those losses. I'm not going to pretend like it's easy, but I'm going to definitively say it's worth it. And it's a much better option than simply sitting down and assuming the role of a victim who has no control over his or her circumstances. All right, let me move on to something a little brighter. The current push to clamp down on free speech is being justified as if free speech were as dangerous as a runaway brush fire. Well, Annie Holmquist says, the more you try to stamp out free speech, the more it spreads. She says, by now you've probably heard about Nina Jankowicz, the woman tapped to lead President Biden's new Disinformation Governance Board, otherwise known as the Ministry of Truth. The self-styled Mary Poppins of disinformation has been wowing audiences with her confident lectures regarding censorship, the dissemination of information, and trust in government. One of the most recently surfaced Jankowicz lectures finds her suggesting that Twitter posts could be edited by verified people like herself in the same way that Wikipedia edits its pages. In other words, kiss your free speech goodbye. For Nanny Nina will make sure to doctor anything untoward that you might say, or rather, anything that dares question the party line. Now, Annie Holmquist says, such news is alarming to those of us who value free speech and freedom of the press. It seems like we're hurling fast toward the tyranny of a despotic government that controls not only language, but also thought. Yet while the situation is bad, she says all is not lost. In fact, we may even be in a prime position to turn around the tactics of censorship and disinformation. Now she says, I came to this conclusion while looking through Alexis de Tocqueville's Democracy in America. He addresses the freedom of the press and the difficulties of striking the right balance between responsible freedom and absolute control of thought. As he noted, small, gradual attempts to suppress the press act as a type of slippery slope until suddenly all citizens, not just the press, find themselves under the feet of a despot. The way down that slippery slope, however, offers several handholds which can be used to slow the suppression of speech and even to reverse it in a mighty way. You start from license of the press, and you march in rank order. What do you do? First, you submit writers to juries, Tocqueville explained, noting that dragging writers before juries simply brings the contested freedom of the press or speech issue before many more ears than would have heard it before. But the juries acquit them, and what was only the opinion of an isolated man becomes the opinion of the country. The same thing happens the more one tries to suppress. Quote, you deliver authors to permanent magistrates, but the judges are obliged to hear before condemning. What someone was afraid to avow in a book is proclaimed with impunity in the defense plea. Thus, what was said obscurely in one account is found repeated in 1,000 others. The expression is the external form and, if I can express myself in this way, the body of the thought. But it is not the thought itself. Your courts arrest the body, but the soul escapes them and subtly slips through their hands. End quote. Now, Annie Holmquist says, look, if just one soul will have the courage to stand up and speak the truth, even with the risk that they might be taken to court or canceled or maligned in some other way, then that truth will spread like wildfire. Back to Tocqueville. In contrast to all material powers, the power of thought often increases with the small number of those who express it. The spoken word of a powerful man, which spreads alone through the passions of a silent assembly, has more power than the confused cries of 1,000 orators. And if only someone can speak freely in a single public place, it is as if he has spoken publicly in each village. End quote. Now, Annie Holmquist says it is in such a process that we can take hope. Today, more than ever, our freedoms of press and speech and thought are being suppressed not only by Nina Jankowicz, but in many other average everyday venues such as classrooms and workplaces. And because of this pervasive censorship, it can be very unpopular to point out facts that run contrary to the narrative. So many of us choose to shut up instead. But she says this is exactly what the suppressors want. Because if they don't have to publicly snuff out, so-called dissident thought, then it won't grow. But if we take courage and we speak the truth in a kind, non-abrasive manner, even if it's just in a casual conversation at the grocery store checkout, over coffee with a friend, or in a comment on social media, she says we may just get the snowball rolling toward freedom once again. Happen to agree. I've got a link to her article in the show notes at thebrianhydeshow.com. It's that speaking the truth in a kind, non-abrasive manner that really does seem to open the door for people who otherwise, you know, might be locked into, you know, an ideological corral of sorts. If you can speak the truth to them with love, not so that they have to admit, yep, you're right, but simply so that they have something to consider and can come to that truth on their own terms, you'd be surprised how many people will open their minds to the possibilities.
This is the Brian Hyde Show.